I think we've all seen that sort of photo, have we? And I'm coming today as someone who is not an expert, just someone who's interested. And there may be people in this room who are far more familiar with Bonhoeffer and his writings than I am. So I'd like to just help us go down a certain way and think about the implications of his life and to question the things that might arise for us out of what he went through in his life. I came to Bonhoeffer largely from my parents, because they would talk about him as I grew up. And we all got to know that he stood against the Nazis and in fact was murdered by them. But just after last Christmas, and really that was about it. Last Christmas I was over in Sydney, caught up with a really good friend of mine, and whenever we're in each other's houses, we're looking at each other's bookcases, so I'm looking at his, and there's Bonhoeffer by Metaxas. And I grabbed it, this thick tome, you could build a house with it, and he said, right, you can have it, you can borrow it. So I've read it. And it's been quite a wonderful journey for me, quite interesting. And there are a number of things that came up for me. First of all, I am a quarter German. So I have my grandmother's German and I've had family over in near Frankfurt and Hanover. And we know them and visited with them. And there's some people who have some pasts that they want to talk about, and there are people who have some pasts they don't want to talk about. And it's quite an interesting mix. I have a fondness for Germany because my grandparents, two grandfathers, and some of us here are in the same boat, were involved in the First World War, and I had a father who was involved in the Second World War who went to bomb the land of his mother. And when I went to school, I had this enormous interest in modern history, and particularly how a nation like Germany, so cultured, the home of Schiller and Goethe and Bach, how does that country lead a world to war, two wars, two horrifying wars in 25 years? Just incredible. How does this happen? So it's been a real interest of mine to try and understand what went on. So I'm reading Bonhoeffer, and suddenly I find I've got a question that I've never thought of asking before. Where was the church in all this, in the Second World War, between World War I and World War II, or even before that? What was the church doing? What were Christians doing? I didn't know that, the answer to that question. Does anyone else know what Christians were doing at that time? And I think, you know, just at the beginning of this year, I didn't know. I think Claire could tell us. Others? You're aware of what Christians were doing? Yeah, some of you have had a good look at Bonhoeffer, probably aware of that. So, Germany is the land of the Lutherans, as is a lot of Europe. And Luther produced his theses in 1517 as essentially a protest about the corruption in the Catholic Church. Here I stand, justification by faith. Wonderful principles. Beautiful principles that have led to us being able to worship God in our own way today. Bonhoeffer was born in 1906 in Wrocław in Western Poland. And psychiatrist father, teacher mother, and a family that did not go to church. He had six other siblings, and three of them were actually killed in two wars. And his family were not religious, but had a strong music and artistic heritage. So they're one of the German cultured families, probably middle class, maybe upper middle class. Now, Bonhoeffer actually displayed musical talent, so even though there was the options of academia, there was also the option for him to become a professional musician. But he was 14 when he actually told his family that he was going to become a pastor, which wasn't necessarily looked upon as being a really great profession. But he went on and completed a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. And he went on to complete his doctorate at Berlin University in 1927. So what's happening around this time in Germany? We've got the end of the World War One. We've got Germany paying reparations back to the Allies in absolute financial crisis. We've got the beginnings of a depression starting to happen after the war. And we've got a Protestant church that in 1922 formed a confederation of churches called the German Evangelical Church, confederation of 28 regional churches. A little bit more formal than, I think, probably similar to our Anglican churches in a way, I imagine, Claire, is that right? Yeah, maybe. The interesting thing about the Lutheran Church in those days, or the Protestant churches in those days, the formal church was becoming increasingly secularised. Now, when we think of the Luther tradition, I mean, he was a colossus, and very much a colossus in the Lutheran Church. The interesting thing, and I'm going to just focus a little bit on the Jews, is that, and he's not the only one, other people have seen the Jews as being people that were guilty of the murder of Christ. So he developed a position around saying that the Jews should be converted to Christianity, and he actually said and wrote some quite vile things about the Jews. So the prevailing view among historians in Germany and around this time is that Luther's anti-Jewish rhetoric contributed significantly to the development of anti-Semitism in Germany, and in the 30s and 40s provided an ideal foundation for the anti-Nazi attacks on the Jews. Luther can't be distanced completely from modern anti-Semitism. And one historian writes that Luther's treatise on the Jews and their lies, Karl Jasper says, there you already have the whole Nazi program. Then the Nazi sympathising German Christians used Luther's statement to justify their anti-Semitism. Then in Germany there's the Aryan paragraph. And the Aryan paragraph is a paragraph in sports clubs, in hotels, in restaurants, saying no Aryans can come, no Jews can come here, or people who are not of Aryan descent. And this started in about 1882. Countless German national sports clubs, song societies, included this paragraph into their constitutions or their statutes. And they served as regulations to exclude Jews, but also Poles, Serbs, Russians and others who weren't Aryan. So we've got this cultural thing happening in Germany when Bonhoeffer lands. And then it extended to banning Jews and so on from the civil service, education, marriage and public health. And so you've got when Hitler comes in and the Nazis are in power, they stipulate that only those of Aryan descent without Jewish parents or grandparents could be employed in the civil service. Then that Aryan paragraph was extended to schools, to universities, and eventually it was accepted nationally, largely without protest. Except within the evangelical church, it led to the splitting off of the confessing church that Bonhoeffer was part of. There's a couple of other things happening in Germany. There's the oath of loyalty. There's the concept of the rule of law, which I won't go into. But then there's the Führer principle. And the Führer principle in Germany is centuries old. And it's about leadership and about the idea that anyone in leadership should be obeyed. So there is the Führer principle, and when Hitler comes into power, he's not the Führer. It's a little bit like Jesus. Christ has been in existence forever, and Jesus becomes the Christ. And in a sense, in Germany, the Führer principle exists within their culture. And Hitler walks into it and said, I am the Führer, and I adopt the Führer principle. So he's walking into, he didn't create anything, he just walked into an idea that was already there. Now, the interesting thing is that the people after the Second World, after the First World War, were really keen to get rid of the monarchy. They're quite happy about that. The Kaiser had led them into this totally, this war that they should have won. But in a sense, they got rid of the Kaiser, but they were lost. They didn't understand. They'd never had democracy before. They never understood democracy. And they're like a dog having caught the car, but doesn't know what to do with it. And this is really what's happening in Germany at the time. Germany had no history. It broke apart into factions, with each faction blaming the others for everything that went wrong. And there was a clamour for order, a clamour for leadership. And you've got the old generals like Hindenburg and Ludendorff who are sitting in the wings, and they take over and they try their hardest. And then there's the reparations, there's the increasing poverty, there's the feeling that Germany is being slighted. And of course, over time, the Jews fall into the place of having caused a lot of this. Where do we go to from here? Bonhoeffer. So let's go back to him. He graduates. This is the world he comes into. And we've got to check the time here. I think we could be here for a couple of hours. we could form a discussion group. Bonhoeffer, he graduates. And goes and spends time in Spain, and then in America. Now, I imagine Bonhoeffer as a sort of guy now that you'd want to have a conversation with. Hale, hearty, good sense of humour, but quite serious. And I get the impression that early on he was very serious and quite formal in his spirituality, quite an adherent to the rules of the church. Then he goes to Spain, and finally America in 1924. So he's only, 19, thereabouts? Is that right? And these gave him a wider outlook on life and helped him move from more of an academic approach to his Christianity to a more practical interpretation of the Gospels. He was moved by the concept of the church's involvement in social justice and protection of those who were oppressed. He goes to the US to do postgraduate studies and goes to the New York City's Union Theological Seminary, and he thinks it's not up to the exacting German standards. There is no theology here, he said. And in the end, he realised that it was really quite a liberal approach to theology. The idea of Christ dying, rising again, was very low on the agenda. The need for conversion was very low on their agenda. But then he met some black theologians who introduced him to the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. And he was off. He loved that. He just loved their joy and their enthusiasm in God. He loved the way that they cared for their poor, their marginalised. It just changed him dramatically to see what they were doing in the black churches in New York. And he just got involved, and he started teaching Sunday school and all that sort of stuff there. And loved it. And then he did a trip down to the southern states and saw the oppression that they were under there, and got involved a bit in a couple of churches there. Then went on a trip to Mexico and saw what they were doing in Mexico, and found that once they were in Mexico, they couldn't get back into the United States. So someone had a connection with someone who got the US ambassador in Mexico to help them out. Bonhoeffer began to see things from below, is the term that's used, from the perspective of those who suffer oppression. He observed, here one can truly speak and hear about sin and grace and the love of God. The black Christ is preached with rapturous passion and vision. So he loved his time there. I won't read all his letters. but he had a voracious appetite for New York culture. If you really try to experience New York completely, it really does you in. Now, that would have been in German at the time. I don't know. I think that's a colloquialism now, but that's what's written down. It really does you in. So he loved the New York culture. His impressions were that it turned from phraseology, understood all the phrases about God and about Jesus and all the theology, to a reality. He understood, he was starting to really think about how do you apply Jesus' life to your life in real life now. So he returned to Germany in 1931. He was ordained as a priest, became a lecturer in systematic theology, as you do, at the University of Berlin. But he became deeply interested in the ecumenical movement, and that was the idea of reaching out past his own particular church group into other churches. Became very interested in that. He was appointed the world to the World Alliance for Promoting International Friendship through the churches, a forerunner of the World Council of Churches, and was one of its three European secretaries. He seemed to have undergone a personal conversion from being a theologian primarily attracted to the intellectual side of Christianity to being dedicated to be a man of faith. Resolved to carry out the teachings of Jesus as he found it in the Gospels. But we do have a picture here of the church he was ordained in. Thought I'd just keep you interested there. That's the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church in Berlin, I'm sorry. No, the old, the old Prussian, old Russian United Matthews Church. That's where he was dedicated, but he also preached at that main church in Berlin, which is now a bombed out ruin near the train station there. Anyone who's been to Berlin, you will have seen that. But Lutherans in this type of church were like any capital church city church, where the church is a beacon for their religion. So people were used to having their Lutheran egos stroked for keeping the grand old Lutheran tradition alive. But Bonhoeffer, whenever he would speak, would give them what he called a kick in the chops. When he read from Revelation, he would read, "Nevertheless, I have something somewhat against thee, because thou hast left thy first love." And then he gave them something that would rouse them out of their self-satisfaction. Let's talk about the Nazi regime. Most Protestants in Germany voted for the Nazis in the elections of summer and autumn 32 and March 33. The churches did not reject National Socialism on principle. The idea of a strong authority and a close bond between throne and altar, of the kind that existed in the empire earlier, the Bismarck empires and so on, was in keeping with the Protestant tradition. A limited number of Protestants, however, objected to the Nazis on moral and theological principles. They could not reconcile the Nazis' claim to total control over the person with the ultimate sovereignty that in Christian orthodoxy must belong to God. So starting, they were really recognising that once church and state start coming together, particularly an autocratic anti-God state, the church becomes like that as well, and it was resisting that. So the Nazis took power, they created the German Evangelical Church. Appointed their own leader, a guy called Ludwig Miller, who I think enjoyed fishing, but it was nothing related to religion. And Hitler imposed new church leadership on this new Reichschurch. And then there's a group called the German Christians who are supporting Hitler as well as a wider group, as a political group. The German Christians, and of course they win 70-80% of seats and voting power in all the voting bits of the churches, synods and presbyteries. And further pro-Nazi developments followed, the elevation of this guy Müller to the bishopric. In late summer, the old Russian church led by Müller adopted the Arian paragraph. So a church adopts the Arian paragraph, effectively defrocking clergy of Jewish descent and any clergy married to non-Arians. So the confessing church, Bonhoeffer and a number of other people with him set up the confessing church. Now, Hitler in one sense, there's stories that he actually claimed to be a Catholic. But according to Hitler's view of Christianity, he didn't like it because it defended the weak and the low, was Jewish in origin, and was invented to enslave free men. Mercy, as advocated for Jesus, was a very dangerous idea. And the love that is central to the Gospels leads to paralysis. Finally, he described forgiveness of sins and salvation of mankind as nonsense. The list leaves little doubt as to the real threat that the Nazis formed to the church. September 33, the Nazis passed the law that included the Aryan paragraph. In November, a rally of 20,000 German Christians demanded the removal of the Old Testament from the Bible. Now, that's interesting. Did anyone know that? Bonhoeffer argued the church had a responsibility to act against these policies. He sought to organise the Protestant church to reject Nazi ideology from infiltrating the church. The ranks of opposition to Nazi infiltration grew, and with Pastor Martin Niemöller, who I imagine many of us are familiar with, Bonhoeffer helped form the Emergency League, which became the Confessing Church, and a group of churches that opposed Hitler and what the Reich Church was doing, and which aimed to preserve traditional Christian beliefs and practices. They insisted that Christ, not the Führer, was the head of the church. However, it's been estimated that only 20% of pastors in Germany at that stage supported that position. Anyway, more about Dietrich. He heads off to London. And in 1933, he was appointed to do German-speaking churches in London. So he really gets around, doesn't he? While he's supporting the Confessing Church back in Germany, he gets to know other churches and other people outside of the Lutheran Church. He really extends his ecumenical principles and his drive to form relationships, probably try and have coffee with as many people as he can. Then he comes back in 1935, and he's presented with a much sought-after opportunity to go and study under Mahatma Gandhi in India. But because he was really starting to be of the view that the words "thou shalt not kill" and "love your enemies" were to be taken literally. And "you do not allow Christians into military service," he believed in a Christian conscientious objection to war. Now, Nazi oppression had intensified, and the seminaries which were training up pastors in the Lutheran Church were being closed down by the Nazis. So he ends up getting a little seminary in an area in northern Germany called Finkelwald for training Confessing Church pastors. And then the oppression grows more and more. And key people in the church in Germany leave Germany. Niemöller is arrested in 1937, and then in August 1936, Bonhoeffer's authorization to teach in the University of Berlin is revoked by the Nazis. So you can see the oppression coming in. But he found other people with large heaps of money and large estates to run his what he called underground seminaries. So he's training up pastors in these underground seminaries. Then in 1937, he publishes his Cost of Discipleship. Has anyone read that totally from cover to cover? Two people. Right. I'm not going to ask you what you think of it, otherwise we'll get stuck. But what an amazing... Perhaps just one word, Mike, from you, one or two words as to what it meant to you. Do you...
Just a radical discipleship.
Radical? Yeah. Yeah. Julie, what did you...
Long time ago.
Okay, let's go. Jen, do you remember?
Devastating.
What was the devastating bit? Yeah. So if we boil it right down, following Jesus is the principle. And this is what caught my attention as I read this book, is that it was in my own journey in discovering how do you follow God, move away from the dogma of that we've all grown up with, maybe as evangelical Christians and so on, and the refreshing connection with what Peter brought to us, has brought to us a few times, just about the commands of Jesus, following the commandments of Jesus. And as I read Bonhoeffer's The Cost of Discipleship, if I can pick away at it, because it is quite a wordy book, in there is this challenge to walk in the footsteps of Jesus, to follow the commands of Jesus. And Bonhoeffer's love, the part of the Bible he loves most is part of what we read this morning, the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. And he is saying that he's really moving away from the church rituals and so on into a simplified Christianity, which is walk in the footsteps of Jesus, just do what he says in the Beatitudes. And that's what he builds on in that whole book, is that whole idea of the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount. There's other things in there as well, but my sense is, having read it over the last month on my Kindle, that is pretty well, if we can boil it all down, that is what it's saying. How are we going for time? He goes back to the United States in 1938. And he goes back for 2 years. He's going to be there for 2 years. He stays 26 days. Yeah. He'd already had initial contact with members of the German resistance. His brother-in-law, who was a member of the army, introduced him to a group seeking Hitler's overthrow. Then they learnt that war was imminent and was particularly troubled by the prospect of being conscripted. So that's where, being a committed pacifist, he wanted to go off to America. When he got to America, he knew he'd made the wrong decision. He believed he needed to go back to Germany. He was worried about the consequences. Here we go. Ah, yes. After much inner turmoil, he soon regretted his decision despite strong pressures from his friends to stay in the United States. I came to the conclusion that I've made a mistake in coming to America. I must live through this difficult pain period in our national history with the people of Germany. I have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share in the trials of this time with my people. So back he goes to America. And he finds a way of joining the army in a non-combative role. Okay, so he joins the German military intelligence service with his brother-in-law. And this is where the spy component of his life comes in. He was denied the right to speak in public or publish any article, but he could join the army, the Abwehr. It was during the darkest hours at that point that he started to question his pacifism, as he saw the need for violent opposition to a regime such as Hitler. Bonhoeffer struggled with how to respond to the evil nature of the Nazi regime. He met the General Secretary of the World Council of Churches, who asked him, "What do you pray for these days?" Bonhoeffer replied, "If you want to know the truth, I pray for the defeat of my nation." So within the cover of the Abwehr, or the intelligence service, the Army Intelligence Service, Bonhoeffer served as a messenger for the small government resistance movement. He visited Norway, Sweden, Denmark and Switzerland and made contact with associates of the British government to try and arrange peace terms. But the feelers of the German resistance were ignored as the Allies pursued a policy of unconditional surrender. Now, within the intelligence service, efforts were made to help some German Jews escape over to Switzerland. And it was in Bonhoeffer's involvement in this activity that led to his arrest on the 5th of April 1943. As the Gestapo sought to take over the responsibilities of the intelligence service, they uncovered Bonhoeffer's involvement in escape plans. For a year and a half, Bonhoeffer was imprisoned at the Tegel Military Museum, and he continued writing, and he produced another book called Ethics. Has anyone read that? Okay. And helped by sympathetic guards, his writings were smuggled out. his love life. He fell in love with the daughter of one of his financiers, a girl named Maria von Wedemeyer. He was 36, she was 18. The two almost spent no time alone together prior to the engagement and did not see each other between becoming engaged and Bonhoeffer's arrest. But once he was in prison, she would visit him while he was in prison. And for a year and a half, Bonhoeffer was imprisoned in the Tegel military prison near Berlin. And there he continued his work in religious outreach to prisoners and guards. And he wrote letters and papers from prison. So after the failure of the Valkyrie plot to kill Hitler, all hell broke loose. And the detention cellar of the House of the... He was secretly removed to the Buchenwald concentration camp. Then Admiral William Canaris, one of the in charge of the Navy, or he was head of the Abwehr at that stage, were discovered, the diaries, and Hitler, in a rage upon reading them, ordered that the conspirators be destroyed. So, on the 8th of April 1945, Bonhoeffer was in the Flossenbürg concentration camp. He was given a cursory court-martial and sentenced to death by hanging with piano wire. He was executed with fellow conspirators such as Admiral Canaris and Hans Oster. Just before his execution, he asked a fellow inmate to relate a message to the Bishop George Bell, one of his long-time associates and friends in England. This is the end for me. This is the end. For me, the beginning of life. And the camp doctor who witnessed the execution of Bonhoeffer later wrote, "I saw Pastor Bonhoeffer kneeling on the floor praying fervently to God. I was most deeply moved by the way this lovable man prayed, so devout and so certain that God heard his prayer. At the place of execution, he again said a short prayer, then climbed a few steps to the gallows, brave and composed. His death ensued after a few seconds. In the almost 50 years that I worked as a doctor, I have hardly ever seen a man die so entirely submissive to the will of God." Bonhoeffer's legacy, just quickly, listening for and obeying Jesus. During his short life as a pastor and teacher, Bonhoeffer stressed the importance of listening for God's will as opposed to blindly following religious doctrine. He detested the idea of cheap grace, the notion that because our sins are atoned by the blood of Christ, it doesn't matter how we live or what choices we make, since we'll be forgiven and redeemed regardless. Bonhoeffer's life and ministry refuted this thinking. He really emphasised Jesus' call to follow him comes to us with promises of the Beatitudes. Bonhoeffer loved the Sermon on the Mount, as I said before, and the Beatitudes. He writes, "The kingdom of heaven will come to those who live thoroughly in renunciation and want for Jesus' sake." And there's one page I was going to read you, which I won't do that now. He talked about the liberation, ease and joy of being involved in discipleship. Bonhoeffer's life story forces me to ask some questions, and some interesting and probably some uncomfortable ones. And the question it brought me to was, is there a point in my life where I will allow myself to be killed for something I believe? And I don't know how many of us ever ask ourselves that question. It's an interesting question, isn't it? I find it extremely challenging. And I have discovered a couple of beliefs that I think I'd do that for. To what degree would I really be willing to sacrifice my own safety and comfort for the sake of my faith? Would I truly be willing to speak out against tyranny and inhumanity under a regime where doing so was so tantamount to treason? Would I intentionally return to a place, Germany, where I knew I'd inevitably face unimaginable adversity and even death, all because of my convictions? Would I really be an advocate for the marginalised and persecuted if doing so would place me in those same categories? The other thing about Bonhoeffer, just to finish off, he wasn't perfect. He had a lot of doubts, and he doubted himself. He doubted what he was writing, and he often wrote his books, our writings, to actually help him understand what he was thinking, rather than necessarily making, you know, absolute pronouncements on what he was writing about. And he occasionally viewed life as a journey through darkness, on a search for God's mysterious, indecipherable purposes. I don't want to live in a society where speaking out for the oppressed could get me executed. I look around the world and I see what's happening in different countries, and I wonder what's happening. We're in such a time of volatility and uncertainty. Enormous change is happening politically. We are rethinking, I know in this church, rethinking our whole faith. And what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to be a Christian in America? Do you, you know, you look at the huge American right over there. What are what's happening there? I get a sense of similarities to Germany 1921, or a little bit later. You see the authoritarian regime starting to come in again. Turkey, Philippines. This playing around with North Korea, China. It's all very challenging. And what are we doing? What happens for us in Australia? Laws on our freedom are being tightened in the name of security. And I think this question about what do I hold on to, what is true to me about God and my faith, my family, what is true to me that I'll hold on to, that I'd hang on to in the face of someone trying to take it away from me. I thank God for our freedom. I thank God for this church and being able to come to a far better understanding of the commands of Jesus and walking in his steps. And I trust that what we've gone through this morning is going to be perhaps some challenges for us just to think through the real essence of what Jesus really means to us. Let's just pray for a moment.